Islamists, Arab nationalists, and Orientalists have all used notions about the Muslim family and Muslim law, as well as the encounter with Europe in the early 19th century, to explain society in the Middle East. But when historian Bashar Dumani set out to explore these notions, he found almost no actual scholarship had been done. Delving deep into two centuries of local records in the Eastern Mediterranean, Dumani did not discover the quote-unquote typical Arab family. Instead, he uncovered a world of differences in how the institution of family was understood and organized. Join us today as he discusses his new book, Family Life in the Ottoman Mediterranean. Bashar, thank you for being here today.
I'm so glad to be speaking with you.
Your book sets out to overturn, it seems to me, some basic and enduring assumptions about family and Sharia courts, and this notion that prior to the encounter with Europe, the beginning of modernity, which is in the early 19th century, there was such a thing as a typical Arab family or a typical Muslim family. What is reductive and wrong about this notion, and how is it used ideologically?
The basic point I would make is that much literature on the Arab world and the Middle East in general, is especially in the social sciences, is based on this assumption that the two key institutions that made the society what it is are family and religion, specifically Sharia.
Mm-hmm.
And to them, that explains why the Middle East is the way it is today, how it came to be, and what its future might be like.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that these assumptions are not based on historical study of family life or of daily legal practices that we might call the Sharia.
But so how are those notions so embedded that we don't even see that they're not founded?
So, because they're so ideologically important. This
Explain.
Is a common problem in the social sciences and other modes of knowledge production. When something is really ideologically important to a current political project, you almost always never find historical study of it, because that kind of messes up the assumption to begin with. It's used to explain, for example, the lack of democracy, entrepreneurial spirit, and many other so-called ills of that part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
The Arab nationalists, for example, consider the Arab family to be the building block of that society. That's what makes us Arabs, they would say.
Mm-hmm.
Islamists often talk about this harmonious relationship between family and Sharia as having existed until the encounter with the West. And that is why they say we must live under the Sharia as before.
Because it was sort of a cataclysmic collision.
Yes, and Orientalists see it exactly the other side of the coin, which is family and Sharia in the traditional Arab or Muslim societies is what explains why these societies are so different from us. In fact,
so it others them in a way.
The opposite of us. It's like looking in a mirror. And that's why they must be reformed. So in fact, the big discussions in public discourse in the newspapers and in the academy for the last 100 years or so has been really revolving around two questions. How or should the family be changed, and how or should the Sharia be reformed?
This makes me wonder something I hadn't wondered before. When you say in the academy and we talk about Middle East scholarship, we're talking about Western scholarship. Has this been studied in the Middle East by Middle Eastern historians?
When I started looking at books on the history of the family in the area, for example, I was interested in, which is the Eastern Mediterranean, I couldn't find anything in the mid-90s. Not a single book on the history of the Arab family that was a product of a serious historical study. So that's the first puzzle. Why is it that the family and religion are frequently invoked but not studied?
So you set out to study what was really going on. You chose to study a family in Nablus and one in Tripoli over two centuries, from the 1660s to the 1860s. And you chose to study the Waqf.
Mm-hmm.
Did I pronounce that right?
You did.
Can you explain your approach? Why these two cities? Why these two families? Why this period of time? And why
sure.
the Waqf?
I chose these for a very specific purpose because these are the forgotten centuries, 1660s to 1860s. These are the forgotten places, the provincial, regional, social spaces that are not Cairo or Damascus or Istanbul. And this is the forgotten institution, legal institution, the Waqf, which is can be quickly defined as kind of an endowment or a trust in which people, for the charitable purposes, endow this property, move it from their ownership to the ownership of God, and use the revenues to support a variety of charitable purposes. Mm-hmm. But in the case of the family Waqf, there was a kind of an insertion between the time of the endowment and the time of the revenues reaching that charitable purpose, which is to say the revenue should go to my descendants until their extinction. And then, so actually it was a way of, I describe it as the creation of a family charter that gives us enormous insight into what people at that time believe family was and how it should be organized and reproduced.
Yeah, it's like a tool for designing, almost for mapping out your belief system.
And the property devolution strategy.
Right.
And combined both a moral and a cultural understanding of what family is, but it was also a mechanism, a very actually expressive and flexible mechanism for designing a property devolution strategy before one died.
Yeah. So you found that these two families approached the Waqf very differently, right?
Well, this was the second puzzle of the book. The second puzzle was not one that I was ready for. I did not believe or expect that the sources would lead me to this conclusion. But in fact, Nablus and Tripoli were very different from each other in terms of how the institution of the Waqf was used, even though they lived in the same imperial space, in the same cultural zone of Greater Syria or Bilad al-Sham.
So that's
and under the same legal system, which is the Sharia.
So that sort of upends this assumption that of this sort of monolithic family
and it basically tells us there's no such thing as a typical traditional Arab Muslim Mediterranean family.
Talk about how they were different.
Well, the primary difference was the inclusion and exclusion of women from property devolution. So in the case of Tripoli, for example, over 98% of all Waqf endowments included daughters and other women.
Wow. Of, even in the 17th century.
Yes.
And 18th century.
Yes. They were included. Whereas in Nablus, overwhelming majority excluded daughters or female children of sons from the property that was endowed, or the revenues of the property that was endowed.
So what does that say about those two differences?
Well, it says that they had very different concerns when it came to the defining who are the kin that count. And that means how property and power relations and hierarchies in the household worked. What were the expectations of children about what they will or will not inherit from their parents, and so on and so forth. It also affected marriage strategies and a whole range of issues about women's access to productive commercial properties.
So a lot was at stake.
An enormous amount was at stake, because this is a situation whereby not just in Nablus and Tripoli, but tens of millions of people in the Ottoman domains, from the Balkans all the way to the Arabian Peninsula, and daily decisions about how to devolve their properties through Waqf instantiated and assumptions or ways of organizing the meaning of family, the moral order of kinship, mm-hmm. a relationship of people to each other and future generations to each other through this mechanism. Mm-hmm. In other words, they defined what family is, and the entire social structure of these areas was done one act at a time. And we
and
cannot understand. Yeah, and very differently, there's a wide diversity of ways of organizing family life, which means there was no one specific form for Middle Eastern or Arab societies before the encounter for the West, and not one specific form afterwards. There was a huge diversity before, and with enormous legacies for how the societies are organized today.
Well, as you're saying this, I'm thinking, why is that? Why is that surprising? Like, where else would we assume this sort of simplicity and this monolithic quality?
It's not unusual in Middle East studies for really radical findings to sound very common sense to people when they think about their own society.
Mm-hmm.
But that's because the Middle East and Muslim societies in general have been studied as exceptional.
Mm-hmm.
And when you realize that, in fact, they may not be so exceptional,
mm-hmm.
that they had an enormous range of difference within them that challenges our views of what they were like, supposedly,
mm-hmm.
then everything falls into place. And you have a much better understanding.
We're talking today with historian Bashara Dumani about his new book, Family Life in the Ottoman Mediterranean. This is Trending Globally. Am I understanding this correctly, that the Sharia court, when someone died, would have determined what happened to that person's property and wealth, but by having a waqf while you're alive, you kind of do an end run around that, right? So how do you explain how the courts and the law, Sharia law, was so at odds with what people actually wanted to do?
So you're right. There's a big difference between inter vivos and post-mortem forms of inheritance. After somebody dies, there's actually clear set of rules in Islamic law about who gets what.
Mm-hmm.
For example, what would a mother get? What would a father get? A brother, a sister? What if you had only daughters or only one daughter, or etc.? All these then produce different formulas for who would get what.
Mm-hmm.
But most people did not wait for that. They wanted to have a say in the devolution of their properties before they died.
Yeah, so, and there you describe this, it's almost performative, as ceremonial.
Yes, they it was a very big deal to endow your properties as a waqf. In a way, you're declaring the foundation of a family.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, family as we know it today is really a product of this ubiquitous use of the family waqf over this period
uh-huh.
of two centuries and continuing on till the end of the 19th century. It's not a way to have an end run around the court. The court actually is what facilitated
mm-hmm.
These practices.
But it preempted what the court would have said if you allowed yourself to die without a waqf, right?
Right, but it's not so much the place of the court to have a position on this. The court existed in every town and city in the Ottoman Empire, and it was a very important state institution
mm-hmm.
That facilitated the governance of property relations on the local level.
Mm-hmm.
The waqf is a legitimate pious act, so it's not like people invented the waqf in order to do this end run. In fact, it's considered the greatest form of charity, because ultimately all these revenues will go to charitable purposes.
Oh, really?
What really the waqf facilitated is to keep away from inheritance or property devolution a number of categories of people who otherwise would have inherited.
Right.
So
it's designating who is important to you and who isn't.
And both Nablus and Tripoli had something in common. They focus relentlessly on the direct lineal descendants of the endower. What they differ really is in who among the descendants would get property. Now, so what the book does is say that there are other systematic differences between the two when it comes to understanding what family is. Mm-hmm. For example, in Tripoli, 50% of Waqf and Dowars were women. In Nablus, it's like 10%.
Oh, wow.
In Tripoli, in a third of the Waqf's female descendants were given equal shares to male descendants, even though in Islamic inheritance laws, right, it's very clear that it's supposed to be 2-1 in favor of the male for a variety of reasons.
Right.
This never happened in Nablus. And there are many, many other differences. Mm-hmm. And so a third puzzle presented itself, which is what explains these differences?
And
so the book talks a lot about a range of reasons, but the most important, in my view, is the political economy of mm-hmm. these two spaces really differed from each other.
Talk a little bit about that. So there's the Tripoli was orchards, and the Fortune was revenues and rents.
Right.
And in Nablus, it was more house-based.
The primary difference is that in Tripoli, the core of the, or the material base of most property individuals was their ownership of mulberry orchards, mm-hmm. mulberry, the white mulberry, because that's the only food that the silkworm eats. Mm-hmm. And so it was a big part of the silk production industry. And citrus as well, uh-huh. which was used for export. So these orchards were on privately owned land, so there's a property difference here. Most of the land actually was already endowed as a waqf, but in Islamic law, they separate between the trees and the land.
They owned the trees but not the land, right?
Right.
So interesting. And yeah. in Nablus, they were maybe more money lending to the,
exactly.
to the peasants around?
Exactly. So in Nablus, merchant households were, and artisans were, the base of the economy. And their entire livelihood depended on their ability to secure the surplus of the countryside, cotton, olive mm-hmm. oil, etc., to make products mm-hmm. Like soap or textiles, and to trade in these commodities. And the only way they could access them usually was through a money lending system called the Selam system, which was a little bit like a forward purchase contract. So right. you say, I'll give you money now, and you deliver in kind later.
Got it.
At a set price that we agree on now. Mm-hmm. And the difference in what the price might be in the future and what you set it now would be the interest or the profit. Whereas the most common contract in Tripoli was a co-cultivation contract. That is to say, a contract in which a woman often would bring in a group of people who would plant the trees, nurse them into maturity, mm-hmm. and do all that they need to do to make them productive, such as pruning, or et cetera, dredging the water canals, planting in between them,
right.
and so on. And at the end of their contract, usually for 8 to 12 years, then they would get to own half the trees.
That explains the difference in the relationship to the waqf, or their approach to drawing up a waqf.
So the other major difference is that this connection between merchants and peasants in Nablus was a very male affair.
Uh-huh.
Merchants went to the countryside. They participated in weddings, they gave gifts, they brought the peasants back to the city, they helped them negotiate the city.
Mm-hmm.
They created alliances between specific merchant houses and clusters of villages in the countryside over generations.
Mm-hmm.
Women were not part of that entire exchange. Whereas in Tripoli, women were very important in the silk industry and in managing the production of mulberry leaves in the orchards.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had much bigger economic clout in the key sector of the city.
Which really does help explain why they figure prominently in the waqf.
Yes.
As beneficiaries.
That's right. In Nablus, men brought their wives to a larger household to live along with the family of his brother or mm-hmm. et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And Tripoli, often men went to live with their wives.
Really? Oh, interesting.
Yes.
We're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you, you've said that Middle Eastern scholarship is built on assumptions that we don't even see.
Yeah.
And that we need to start building knowledge on actual historical mm-hmm. studies. So mm-hmm. is this a political act? As a historian, it feels to me like there's intention there,
mm-hmm.
very clear intention.
This book is, in a way, an attempt to do two things. One is to challenge pervasive discourse on the three most important zones of knowledge production in Middle East studies, which is about Islam, women, and modernity.
Mm-hmm.
They all depend on these assumptions yes. about the past.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a way to challenge conventional scholarship and public discourse on these issues, but it's also an attempt to build an alternative model for doing the history of the region that doesn't depend so much on this question of the encounter with the West, which is right. really the fundamental departure point for most studies.
So instead, it's really like, what was life really like?
Yes. So that has to do with the choice of the period.
Mm-hmm.
Most studies of the Middle East begin in the second half of the 19th century and move forward because they believe that this is the rupture that gives us the Middle East as we know it today. So I do an earlier period.
Mm-hmm.
Most focus on the big cosmopolitan cities because they feel these are the contact points with the West, and therefore they are the nodes through which this change in the area happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I've choose provincial regions.
Mm-hmm.
And most studies focus on intellectual or political elites, the so-called notables.
Mm-hmm.
And this one really focuses on the average property-holding individuals. An important finding of this book is that the capitalist transformation of Nablus and Tripoli did not lead to a increasing similarity between the two. It led to increasing difference.
Right.
What really happened here is that the more that Nablus was integrated into the world capitalist economy, the more competitive the relations between different merchant households, the more they excluded women.
Interesting.
But in Tripoli...
So capitalism didn't have this modernizing effect.
No, just the opposite.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting.
Exclusion is a modern phenomenon. Mm. Whereas in Tripoli, the more it became involved in the silk industry and in the export of citrus, the more the sort of the size of the middle class and the egalitarian kind of political economy grew.
Have you gotten any reactions to the book yet?
Only from some fellow academics, but not. It hasn't been out long enough to be reviewed.
Well, it is eminently readable, and I highly recommend it. And I really thank you for coming in to here today to talk to us about it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Bashara.
Thank you for this opportunity.
This has been Trending Globally, Politics and Policy. If you enjoyed today's conversation, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Stitcher, or download us on your favorite podcasting app. If you like us, rate us, and help others who might enjoy the show find us. For more information, go to watson.brown.edu.